Good day, my friends, and welcome to the Craig Shapiro Tennis Podcast. Today's show is brought to you by Diadora, brand made legendary by Bjorn Borg, currently worn by world number 25, Jan Lennard Struff, world number 42, Martina Trevisan. See them at Diadora.com. Use my code APPROVED in all caps at HollywoodSports.com for 15% off of all Diadora performance tennis shoes. It's with great pleasure to announce that ScopeSports.io is the official fan club platform of the podcast. With Scope Fan Clubs, you can access premium behind-the-scenes content, chat with the athletes, and put yourself in play for exclusive giveaways. These guys are on the move, getting ready to announce more and more players on their platform. See them at scopesports.io to see what they are all about. Welcome aboard, fellas. He got to 28 in the world. He was the head of the USTA Player Development Program. He's been a broadcaster since he left the tour in 1998, and he is now the co-president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame. His name is synonymous with tennis like no other. Patrick McEnroe is today's guest.
You were in Vegas for Netflix.
Right.
You went home?
I went home because my daughter had ankle surgery, my oldest daughter.
That's the only reason you went home. You would have just come
right
here.
That's the only reason I went, because it was only like 2 days. So I flew home, and then I was home for a day and a half, and then I flew back.
And what's the story of the surgery?
It went well, but she's in a boot. You know, she's on crutches for a couple weeks.
Her name is?
Victoria.
And she had surgery. Why?
She had some bone edema in her right ankle. It's been bugging her for like 3 years. She's a tennis player, pretty good tennis player. She's going to play in college, hopefully at Duke. She's going to Duke next year.
Went home for 36 hours, and now you can't. Now you're in the desert.
Correct.
That's it. Yeah. For our listeners, the gentleman you hear, former world number 28, former head of player development at the USTA, a job he held for some time. We're going to talk about that. He is now are you co-president or you're president of the Hall of Fame?
I think co-president.
Co-president.
Kim Clijsters is with me, and she's amazing. Yeah.
He's co-president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame in Newport, Rhode Island, a place that I hold close to my heart, on my home turf. That is Patrick William McEnroe.
Thank you for that. You know, William came from my mother's father, who was named William Tresham, Bill Tresham. My mom's maiden name is Tresham. So she went by K.T. McEnroe, K. Tresham McEnroe.
So, you know, the funny part of that is, just quickly, is I thought that you were, for some reason I had in my head, you were Patrick John McEnroe.
No.
And then I thought you did something like weird Irish craziness. And it was John Patrick McEnroe.
John Patrick. My dad is John Patrick McEnroe. And, and I'll give you this other one before we get into it, because this used to drive my dad crazy.
Yep.
People used to call him John McEnroe Sr. John is John P. McEnroe Jr.
He was a stickler.
So people
to that.
Would call him senior, and he would just.
They call him senior on TV. He didn't like that.
No, he didn't like that at all.
I'm not senior.
Exactly. So there you go.
Listen, it's great to see you. We are actually in a conference room at the JW Marriott in Palm Desert. The BNP Paribas Open is in day 5, and we are in full effect.
Yeah, it's been an awesome tournament. We did all our meetings here at the JW Marriott for the International Tennis Hall of Fame. So now I'm out here for a few more days, and tennis paradise, baby. You got to love it.
Now listen, you know we do a 5-set format. The first set is the off-the-court report. Mm-hmm. You're like half and half. You're like off the court and in broadcasting, but then you're back on the court at the McEnroe Academy.
Yes, I'm on the court pretty much Monday through Thursday when I'm home, which is a lot more now than it used to be because ESPN's doing less, although with the Hall of Fame, I'm on the road a little bit with them and for them. So it's actually great because the years at the USTA that you mentioned was a more administrative job, obviously a very political job, but much more overseeing the program here. I oversee the program, but we have such a great team there that I actually get to be on the court with the kids and the coaches pretty much whenever I'm there, which, as I said, is Monday through Thursday. It's great.
John McEnroe Tennis Academy. Yep. JMTA, sponsored by BNP.
Yes, BNP sponsors our program that's part of our charity, which is JMTP, the Johnny Mac Tennis Project. And within that, we give opportunities to kids in inner city schools to come and play tennis. We have an excellence program for kids that sort of graduate from that and then maybe end up in the JMTA, which is the tennis program for kids. And then we have BNP Mac One, and that helps us sponsor our top kids that are normally wouldn't be able to afford it. So these kids have to be at a certain level financially within their family, and then they can qualify for the scholarship. And then we've had numerous kids in the last few years go to UNC, go to Harvard, go to Princeton. We've got two girls this year that'll be graduating from our academy. One going to Boston College, one going to Tulane. They've been at the academy since they were 6 years old.
That's very similar to, I'll never forget, you might know Dr. Keith Raskin, the hand arm specialist.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so Raskin doesn't accept insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to him, man, you don't accept insurance. He's like, we don't, but I reattach people's arms that can't afford it
right
40 times a year for mm-hmm. free. That's a similar. It's similar expensive situation. To go to your
yes,
academy.
It yes, it is.
It's very not expensive. Cheap.
It's not cheap at all. And
no.
We're very grateful to have the business that we have in New York City, which is a lot of people from the city. But we're also very grateful that our company, Sport Time, under its umbrella, we have our charity. They give us the courts. They give us the court time. The coaches at a discount to work with those top kids and lots of other kids that I said that wouldn't be able to afford it.
And you live in Westchester. You drive there.
I drive there. Yeah, it's about 20, 25 minutes. No traffic.
Do you have your own parking spot? Reserved?
No,
for Patrick?
I do not.
You do not?
No. And it's hard to get parking at our academy, especially from like 3 to 8, because that's when all the kids program.
And what about your brother? Does he have his own parking spot?
He doesn't have his own. No, but he usually comes earlier in the day. I'm there more mid, late afternoon. I mean, I stay usually till the end of the sessions at 8. But it's unbelievably crowded. That's actually parking's one of our main problems because we just expanded. We went from 20 courts to we now have 30 courts.
30 courts?
Yeah, 30 courts. 16 hard, 14 clay.
Let's move into the second set. This is the On the Court Report.
Okay.
We talk about the business of tennis here, all the machinations and politics and politics mm-hmm. and things. I just want to get into it. The USTA cut 40% of its development budget. Your thoughts?
You know, I'm a little out of the loop as far as the politics, and I haven't paid a lot of attention. I have a few people that I know that are still in player development. Most of the coaches, many of whom were there when I was there, are all gone. You know, so I've heard a lot of rumblings from those folks that are pretty unhappy about the cuts. So I don't know the ins and outs of why it's happened. I know that, you know, the move to Orlando, I think overall for the USTA was a good move. Obviously, I was there when those decisions were being made. Once they were implemented, that was when I left. But I think U.S. tennis overall is doing quite well. You know, when I was there, we were more looking at trying to train the kids that wanted to be trained by us. But now it seems like they're maybe pulling away from that as far as having the full-time option. We try to do both, have a part-time option, obviously support the kids and their local coaches and their communities, but also have a place where they could come, which was Boca for many years, which a lot of the guys were seeing, you know, at the top of men's tennis now. They started there.
You just smashed directly into my question. You went on record when you took the job that the work that you and Jose Higueras, the great Jose Higueras, were going to do,
mm-hmm.
that programs that you were going to implement
mm-hmm.
were going to benefit the 12-year-olds, the 13-year-olds, yeah. and it wasn't going to see an immediate impact.
Right.
Now, Tiafo, Opelka, Fritz, Tommy Paul, Seb Korda,
mm-hmm.
Eubanks, Shelton,
mm-hmm.
are they reaping the benefits of things that you guys put into play?
Mm.
And do you feel like maybe your time should be looked at different? Because you had an acrimonious
right.
finish.
Yeah. Well, that's for other people to decide. I believe that we did impact things in a positive way. Some of those players were full-time part of our program. Some were part-time. Some got supplemental help. And, I mean, that was the vision. The vision was to offer opportunities to kids to raise the bar. This, to me, was the biggest thing that we tried to do, was to raise the bar of coaching and training. Because you could argue it or not, there's a lot of great individual coaches in this country. But as a country, we fell behind what they were doing in Europe from a coaching standpoint, technically, physically, and so on. So we tried to raise the bar within what we were doing, And I believe that helped raise the bar all over the country with what other coaches and programs were doing. So I'm not going to say that directly some of these guys, you know, Sebastian Korda's dad pretty much, took him through the juniors. And I remember talking to Peter and saying, we should bring him to Boca for a bit. And he didn't want to do it, you know, at a certain time. I think he did it as he got a little bit older. But again, I think we had an impact on being there, raising the bar. Jose was very disappointed when I left, which was after, I believe it was about a 7-year run that I had. And because he said, and we thought it was going to be a 10 to 15 year plan. So he always said right from the start, I hope they give us the 10 years. But we know how the USTA works. There's always, politics involved. And I had a great run. I felt that we made a positive impact. And to your point, yes, I feel very proud of what we did. And I communicate with a lot of those guys, whether it's Jose, Jay Berger, Ola Malmquist. You know, by the way, we did a lot for women's tennis, too. You know, I remember the first time I went down to Boca and I went to Ola, who at that time wasn't running women's tennis. But I said, wait a second.
For our listeners, yeah. Ola Malmquist, if you ever go to a tournament, you see this guy. He's
in a towel.
He's a tall, lanky fellow dressed in a warm-up suit that's typically a USTA. He's toweled up, and he is at every American player's match, period. Sorry, continue.
And he does it all behind the scenes.
Ola Malmquist.
Unbelievable.
One of the guys behind the scenes in American tennis. Sorry, continue.
And he's Swedish originally. He played at the University of Georgia, by the way. So he was amazing. He knew when I would say to him, hey, Lola, what's Shelby Rogers doing? You know, when they were 17, 18, 19. Hey, what's Sloan's doing? He knew exactly what their program were, whether it was within the USTA or not in the USTA. So those guys had a huge impact. And I think all of them left the USTA like, it's too bad. I don't feel that way. I feel like, I knew what the writing would be on the wall because I wasn't afraid to piss people off. And I saw that as part of my job to do that. And to not just kowtow to everyone, but I'm extremely proud of what our entire team accomplished over the years.
You are the newish president of the Tennis Hall of Fame. Your organization sold its license, longtime license for the men's ATP 250 that was played right after Wimbledon. It was always a tough date.
Yep.
You sold it to the Qatar Public Investment Fund. That is going to now fold into a 500. Right. Can you explain that and what that all means?
Well, first of all, we're going to still have professional tennis in Newport. So let me say that. In fact, I just sent a screenshot today to the rest of our Hall of Fame leadership staff with the draw of the tournament in Phoenix this week. 8 players seated are in the top 80 in the world. I think the cutoff was like in the high 80s to get in the tournament. That's way stronger than the 250 that we had. So our model going forward is going to be second week of Wimbledon, men's and women's challenger event. It's going to be great. We're going to get players from that lose in the first week of Wimbledon. Chris Eubanks is the number one seed in Phoenix, right? Yeah. We're going to get some people like that. You got guys like Fognini, Wawrinka playing in it, Murray, Monfils played at challengers last year. So we will have professional tennis. But the bottom line, Craig, and you know probably more about the politics going on than I do, but the ATP was trying to get rid of some of the 250s, make the bigger tournaments bigger, make the 500s bigger, have less 250s. Newport was going to go away as a 250, whether we liked it or not at some point. The opportunity in front of us was presented to us. And in fact, when we first took this job, Dan Faber and I, who's my boss and this new CEO, we went to Paris. It was our first trip. And someone approached us in Paris and said, I'd like to have a meeting with you. I understand you're selling your tournament. We're like, what? What are you talking about? Little did we know what was already going on behind the scenes with the ATP. So we got a great deal. We got a deal that we couldn't pass up. Remember, the Tennis Hall of Famers are not for profit. It was too good of a deal for us to pass up. We have to improve the museum, which is amazing. We have to improve the ground, some of which are not in great shape. We have to do a lot outside of just the tournament, but the tournament itself is going to be the second week of Wimby. It's going to be a great success. It's going to be men and women. It's going to be a festival. And the induction ceremony is going to be a different week from when this tournament takes place. So I think it's a win-win for the Hall of Fame.
what's your opinion of sort of this Middle East play, the Saudi play, the Qatar play, the Emirati play? It's big money.
It's big money. I always say to people like that are sort of outside the sports world, people ask me this a lot. I go on news shows about it. You know, how could tennis, you know, get into Middle East, whatever? First of all, tennis has been in the Middle East forever. I played the first tournament ever played in Doha, you know, 20-some years ago. Okay, so tennis has been there. Tennis, there's so much money. Formula One's there. World Cup was there. Okay, golf, we know what's happened with the LIV golf thing. And I think tennis had to get out in front of this and make sure that they don't get taken over, okay, and lose control of what the tour is. So I think that, in a way, is a positive. I know that all the leaderships of the various organizations have been meeting, getting together, how to figure this out. Why is it okay for the U.S. government to investing and spending money in Saudi Arabia? And every hedge fund guy I know or financial person I know who's raising money, we're going to Saudi Arabia. You know, this is where we got to raise money. So tennis can't do it? I don't buy that.
What transpired in the meetings this weekend?
Really, these meetings were about updating people on some of which we've just discussed, about what's the plan moving forward for the tournament, what's the plan moving forward for the museum, what's the plan moving forward, I think most importantly, I mean, they're all important, but for the induction weekend, which I think is going to become, as we presented to the board, likely become more than just a weekend, but really become like a mini festival with music, with food. I could see an exhibition match between some top young players coming from all over the world with some Hall of Fame, either players that are going in that weekend if they want to play, maybe some other Hall of Famers. We want to connect more with the living Hall of Famers. You know, we had an event here. We had Mats Wilander. We had Rosie Casals. We had Fred Staley. God bless him, was here. You know, the new inductees like Vijay Amitraju will go in. Rick Draney, Kim Kleist, Rick Draney, who went in last year in the wheelchair category. So we want to engage those players more and give them opportunities where they can be part of the Hall of Fame. And you know what? Make some extra dough.
There's an Adderall situation on tour. What can you tell us about that?
I don't know much about it.
The TUE, it right. seemed like it's being abused. We're hearing it right. behind the scenes. Yeah, yeah. Have you been hearing anything?
Players in every sport are always looking, you know, for some sort of advantage, you know, how to figure out how to beat the system. So they've been doing it in other sports. There's always been rumblings in the tennis world. I mean, we in the tennis world, even when I was playing, pretty thoroughly tested throughout the year. But there's always somebody that's trying to figure out how to be one step ahead. And with all the nutrition out there, with all the science behind what players are doing, which is overall very good for the game. And we've got these all-time greats still playing. And we've got guys who are just really good players still playing into their mid-30s. So it's not just the Djokovic's and Serena, as she did, and Roger. It's players that are in their mid-30s that are still playing at a high level. And, you know, when you have a Fabio Fognini, for example, who was a top 10 player, now he's wherever he is. But, you know, he's a name. People know who he is. It's good to keep people like that in the game. And part of why they're in the not because they're cheating, but because they're understanding how to keep themselves in better condition for a longer period of time.
Yeah, that was a good pivot right there. Yeah. Francis Tiafoe appears to be in a little bit of a free fall. Can you chime in on that? You guys were in Australia.
I was in Laver Cup too, where he's been a stalwart for Laver Cup, and he's been great on Laver Cup, as he was last year. And I think that getting to semis the Open was amazing for him, as he did in 2022. I think he then became sort of a bigger star, certainly in the U.S., which is something he loves. He likes to be out there. He loves the spotlight. He's a great young man. He's just great to have on the team. But I think that, you know, he got a taste of it, and I think he wants more. And I think he realized last year, which is part of the reason I believe he split with Ferreira, who did a great job with him for a number of years, was that he felt like he was sort of stagnating a little bit. He was, you know, he was in there between 10 and 20, and he's like, okay, I want to be in, the, you know, compete for majors. And so sometimes when you take, you know, you're looking at that, you could take a step back before you take a couple of steps forward. I know Diego, his coach, Diego Moyano, he worked with us for many years at the USDA. He's a great guy, knows what he's doing, but it's a big change for him. It's a total personality shift from a Ferreira to a Moyano. And I think for Francis, he's got to set his sights on, okay, how do I get better? How do I improve? And then, you know, he's going to take some lumps along the way, which he's been doing recently.
Concern?
Concern, yeah. Definitely concern for him because I think he's great for tennis. He's, you know, for American tennis. So,
But it's a long way to come back sometimes. Even though you're 16 in the world, you just have another bad loss. And another, you know.
Yeah. I'm concerned, yeah. And I think it proves more than ever how hard it is to stay at the top, how to be at the top. And you see guys that have a good run here or there. I mean, Fognini's one guy. You see guys that make a run to the top 10. And to be able to stay there and consistently be, look at Tsitsipas. He's fallen out of the top 10. The guy was, you know, competing in a couple of major finals. So unless you're one of these guys who's going to be an all-time great, a Hall of Famer, dare I say, you know, whether it's the Sinner, Alcaraz, Medvedev, and so on, it's hard. It's hard to stay at the top. Is Taylor Fritz going to be able to stay there? Tommy Paul. I mean, these guys are doing great. But to, you know, sometimes when you see that carrot, like, oh, I want it so bad. I want to get top five. I want to, you know, win a major. Sometimes you take maybe some risk in what you're doing with your game, with your mindset, that you can sometimes take a step back before you can take those two steps forward.
Does anyone have any feel for why Jess Pegula shut down her coach?
I have no idea. I could tell something was amiss in Australia. I'd never seen her like that on the court. In fact, I said to Mary Jo or Pam, I said, man, she just looks like the last place she wants to be is on this tennis court right now. Then, you know, it was shortly thereafter that she pulled the ripcord. I think she even pulled out of the doubles, didn't she, down in Australia? But she was out of there quickly. So you could tell something was amiss. She's an amazing competitor. She was knocking on the door, obviously, but she's someone without that big weapon. So you're wondering, oh, can she win one? I'm not sure she can, you know, even if she's maximizing what she has. But I don't know what went on behind the scenes. I mean, hopefully she can right the ship and have another, you know, solid year because she's been so maybe the most dependable top player, certainly the most dependable American. I mean, Coco wins the Open, obviously takes it to another level, but she's been rock solid for a couple of years.
Last question here. What can you tell us about Emma Navarro?
I love her game. I mean, I love her attitude.
You're about to say technique.
No, I'm going to say technique. I
love her game.
I mean, I like her athleticism. She's not extremely big, so she lacks, you know, firepower, but I love to see the players from college, you know, doing well. And we've seen more on the men's side. We're starting to see a few more on the women's side. I mean, I hope Jen Brady can come back. She was awesome. So athletic, you know, injuries have roughed her up big time.
Big time.
So I love to see someone like Navarro, you know, get to that level. Because as I'm seeing in our tennis academy, Craig, I mean, it's pretty hard to get that good at tennis that you can make it in the pros. It's tough, harder than it's ever been.
Well, I don't think anyone saw her.
No.
You know, knocking on the top 20 door. That's for sure.
So again, it's good for college tennis. It's good for the programs. We have great facilities, great coaches in college, great competition, and anything that encourages more kids to go that aren't a no-brainer making it in the pros, they should be going to college.
Do you know her father?
I know of him. I don't know him
personally.
You don't
know him?
I don't know him personally. No.
This guy's a big player in tennis, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I know. Yeah.
He's like a Medici. I mean, this guy is doing a lot. Have you heard anything else that those guys are doing?
All I know is that they were trying to get the tournament out of Cincinnati.
And I thought that was a bluff.
I don't know. You see, you know more than I do about this stuff. Believe it or not, I actually stay out of this stuff now. I was so involved in politics in the USTA because I had no choice. But I kind of enjoy not being involved in it too much. I've got my academy. I've got the ESPN. I've got my Hall of Fame. And oh, by the way, I have three teenage daughters and my wife, who's busier than ever. So I got plenty to deal with. This is what I used to say when I was at the USTA, Craig. I don't get involved in things that I can't impact. Okay, and I think that was a good lesson for me at the USTA. There's certain things I'm like, listen, Wayne Bryan used to write me missives all the time, you know, just berating me, attacking me about this, that, you know, junior tennis, softball tennis. By the way, look how that took off. I took so much crap for that. For my couple of years at the USTA about the red ball, the short court, everybody came after us. I went on a tour. People attacked me nonstop. And guess what? Every single program, academy, club is doing it.
That's de rigueur now.
Exactly. And they just gave us so much shit for doing it. But the point I was getting to was people complain there's too many foreign players playing in college tennis. I don't disagree with that. But how am I going to change that? The NCAA is going to do whatever the heck they want. And tennis is not at the top of their agenda, in case you haven't checked. Okay, so I was like, you know what? It is what it is. I'm not going to fight that. That's not my battle. I can't win that battle. I'm going to fight the battles that I think I can impact and do something positive for, you know, the program when I was there, for tennis in general. And you know what? It's harder to get a scholarship now in tennis, which is a reality. But the level of play has gone up considerably. And why do you think that is? Because there's better players, whether they're from Serbia, Croatia, Toledo, Ohio, or New York City. There's better players, and I think that's raised the bar for guys like Eubanks and Shelton to come through college and become, you know, legit top 30, if not higher players.
100%. Let's move into the third set. This is the portion of our show where we talk about your career. We've already done that.
We already did that.
You've been on the show, but I came up with a...
This is a 6-0 set. But
No. I came up with a good idea.
Okay, let me hear.
I want to talk about Patrick, the broadcaster. What is your best configuration? Is it you, Fowler, and your brother?
I won't go there. I'm just going to say this, that I love doing what I'm doing. I worked hard and diligently for many years to be able to play multiple roles so that I could have – I'm not John McEnroe, okay? No, I'm not Chris Fowler when it comes to what, you know, his persona and what he does at ESPN for football and so on. I'm not Andre Agassi. But I learned early on that I was very good at what I was doing. But I also learned that in the TV world, it's also about the stars, right? It's about who's got the name and who's, you know, done it the most when it comes to being the top analyst. So I worked hard. I did my own radio show. I watched what Cliff Drysdale was doing. I learned from him. I learned from Fowler. I learned from, you know, studio hosts. I can do anything. I can do all those
There's
roles.
No doubt. But yeah. What do you like the best when you're in the – do you like a two-man box? Do you like a three? Do you like two? And
you know,
do you like three and a sideline reporter?
I can't – and I'm not just dodging it. I really can't say definitively I like – I mean, we in Australia, we did myself and my brother and Kyrgios, you know, came in. And he was great. To me, that was super fun.
Did you enjoy Nick?
I enjoyed him a lot.
I was there, so I didn't hear the broadcast.
Yeah. No, I've known him for a while through Labor Cup. He's very smart, very analytical. You know, he's fun. And I think that was great. Doing it with Fowler and John is great because, you know, when John first came over, I was sort of the lead color guy. And I could see the writing on the wall as ESPN was getting more into tennis that at some point they're going to get the majors. And that's exactly what happened. And they're going to bring my brother on. And he's Johnny Mack. So I learned how to do play-by-play so that, you know, always one of my goals was to work with my brother, whether it's as a play-by-play guy or as another analyst guy. So I can do it all. You know, one year at the Open a couple years ago, right, during the COVID time, they didn't want all three of us in the booth because it didn't look good for COVID. So I said, I'll go courtside. I'll do it courtside.
Yep.
And so when you're courtside, that's a different role.
Yeah.
You know, and so they ought to make it like you're three in the booth courtside. I said, no, that's not how it goes. If I'm courtside, I'll chime in, you know, less. I'll talk about the wind. I'll talk about the things that matter that I can see courtside. So to me, the versatility that I've developed over the years has allowed me to, you know, keep a job for 27 years with ESPN, and that's what I intend to do in the future.
Right, you become like a bit of a Swiss Army knife. Is there a favorite? Do you like being the lead? Do you like being second color? Do you like?
I like being on the match. I like doing the big matches.
You want to be on the big matches.
So I
want to
be in. So I'm not going to say, you know, it's one or the other. You know, doing the Wimbledon final. You know, I still pinch myself. I'm like, it's the Wimbledon final. You know, Federer's walking out. Novak's walking out, and I'm here with my brother and Chris Fowler. I mean, come on. I mean, I was 28 in the world. I wasn't like, you know, didn't win Wimbledon. I didn't have a chance to win these tournaments. Did I get some help because my name was McEnroe? Absolutely. You know, early on. Did I take advantage of that? Have I? I believe I have. So I love doing it all. I love being part of it. I do like being able to show that I can host and do play-by-play. I think I've evolved over the years, and I'm very comfortable doing that. It was great to do it at the Netflix Slam, you know, which is an XO, but a big event with Courier.
That was a real A-team of not just broadcasters, but production as well. I watched that credit roll, and, you know, I know everybody in that. Yep. That was an all-star team of production.
Big time
all-star team production event. Are we going to see more from Netflix?
This was a great event for them. They were extremely happy. And you're right. They put a lot into this. They put a lot of production value. I thought it looked great. You know, the setup was great.
It was great. It was very good. It was very good.
Good. Well, you would tell me otherwise.
100%. I'll tell everybody if I didn't like it. It was very good.
I think that the that could be part of the future of tennis. You know, whether it's Netflix, whether it's the other tech companies, Amazon, Apple, Google, what have you. If we can get those kind of companies interested in tennis, that's a win. It's a win-win.
Did you feel pressure there to do well because it was a new player on the street?
No.
Or just your producers keep you, Bob Feller, they keep you loose? Yeah. You just know what you're doing.
I know what I'm doing. Love being part of it. As I said, I've got a lot of experience in all the roles.
Yeah.
So I know what, I did it with Courier for the first set. Then Andre came in for the second set for a bit of it, which is a different dynamic. You know, he's Andre, so you got to let him have his run and have his space. He's our Vegas guy. He's tennis. Jim understands that. I understand that. So again, it's understanding the role for the situation, the match, what's going on in the match. I'm just really proud that I've been able to be part of it and still am a part of it.
But you made a foray into the news when COVID happened, and that seemed like that's continued. You come in to CNN when like there's some hot button topics as a expert commentator.
Obviously, I started with them when the COVID stuff was hitting and the Djokovic story blew up in Australia. Then it sort of morphed into me doing more political sport stuff that was outside of tennis. I actually did a few of the political shows, some roundtable shows that were just on cultural topics and political shows. I love doing it because for me, it's a different kind of challenge. So I have to really do my homework. You know, people ask me all the time, do you do a lot of homework for tennis? I said, I live tennis every day. I don't really do that much homework unless it's a player I don't know, because I'm doing it every day. I know who's playing here every day. But when it comes to politics or, very touchy subject, you got to make sure you're dialed in. So when I'm on one of those shows, I do a lot of work, which for me is fun. I was a political science major in college, so I've always been interested in politics. And doing that has been fun. I've been doing a lot this year with News Nation, which is sort of an up-and-comer in that world. So I enjoy it. It's sort of extra work. But it's something that kind of gets my juices flowing because it's something different. And I like doing it a lot.
Let's move it into the fourth set. This is a 10 ball scramble. I say it, you say what comes in your mind, we go fast.
Okay.
Simona Halep.
Glad she's back.
Any opinion about what happened there?
It seems like she got taken advantage of.
Mouratoglou.
It seems like he was part of the issue there. Yeah. Again, I don't know all the details, but that's what I mean, just from reading between the lines and through the lines.
Jensen Brooksby about to come back.
I mean, there's some level of stupidity that goes into not, being there for when they knock on your door, or they ring your bell, or they send you an email for three times. You got to take some responsibility.
But he had double wrist surgery too.
Well, that's a different topic. I mean, I hope he can come back because the kid's got, a very fun player to watch.
He was right there.
Unorthodox, and a real competitor. So let's hope he can come back. I was talking a bit more about the suspension thing, but obviously the wrist issues are maybe even more serious.
Do you know the kid?
Not well, no. I don't know him well.
The reemergence of Andre Agassi in tennis. Big Andre year.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, he's awesome to have around, and nobody analyzes the game the way he does. The X's and O's and the interest in that. He's always been like that. So he is one of the legends of tennis, and it's great to have him back, wanting to be out there.
When you spoke to him in Vegas, what did he have to say for himself?
He was awesome. He actually asked me how we should handle the match, when he came into the booth. I said, listen, this is an extra. He said, is it okay if we, talk over a point? I said, yeah, it's okay. This is not the Wimbledon final. I said, people want to hear from you. You're here. Let's take advantage of it. Let's take advantage of it. So we should also talk about other topics. I mean, it is an XO. It ended up being a pretty entertaining match and a pretty high-level match. I thought the tiebreak was cool at the end.
They put on a good show.
Yeah, they put on a good show. Nobody knows how to put on a show like Andre, so he gets it. Yeah.
Is it true John is going to be stepping down from Laver Cup and Andre is going to be taking his spot?
I've heard a rumor to that effect, yes.
What happens to you?
I had a great run. Yeah.
Let's move into the fifth and final set. This is the king of the court. If you were the king of tennis, you could make a change in the sport with a swing of the racket with no aggravation. What would it be?
Not much. You know, I
you're happy with it.
I mean, this is actually one of the thoughts I've been having to myself quite often in the last year, especially. I'm sitting there. I'm walking in the Australian Open. Were you there? You weren't there, right? Were you in Australia?
Yes, I was.
You were. Pretty much every late afternoon, early evening, I had a little bit of break, and I'd go walk around the grounds, and I'm like, this is freaking amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, for the kids,
yeah.
The 20-year-olds out partying, just drinking with police around, so monitoring everything, the big screens, the courts, you know, the bar next to the, what was it, outside court six or something. And of course, the U.S. Open last year was a monster success. And I'm thinking to myself, I really get irritated when people say, like, tennis isn't doing great. I'm like, what planet are you on? I mean, tennis is doing unbelievably well internationally. The bigger events are bigger and better than ever. I think we all, you know, would love to see us have more mid-level events in this country. But the bottom line is we need top players to be participating in those events for those to be successful. It's the same in Europe. You know, Europe has a little bit of an advantage over us because tennis is just generally more popular. But I really think tennis is doing amazing. I love the fact that all the majors finally agreed on something with the 10-point breaker. I think that's been a great innovation. I mean, I guess we could go to play lets. You know, they do it in college. It's funny, at our academy, you know, we have kids playing on the ITF junior circuit, kids playing in the USA. So they'll be, we'll start the point to the sets in our session. Oh, are we playing lets or not? Because they're either going to play a USA tournament this weekend, you don't play lets, or an ITF tournament where you play lets. So I'm like, you know, it's probably time that we just all play lets. I mean, I don't think is it going to really change the game? You know, that's just, to me, rather relatively small detail. But I really think that tennis overall as a sport is doing incredibly well.
Hey, man, this was a pleasure.
Game, set, match.
And I want to just thank you. Where do you go next?
Heading up to Portland, Oregon tonight to do some charity work for a great charity up there, the Portland Tennis Education Foundation, which I appeared at their gala last year. So I'm doing some lessons and dinner to help continue to raise money.
Now, does Ian Hamilton have anything
Ian
to
Hamilton
do with that?
Okay. And Mike Nakajima from Nike.
Okay. So you see in the old Nike crew.
The old Nike crew. I'm back here for some stuff with BNP, and then I'm off. Actually, you're going to like this, Greg. I bought my own suite at the Miami Open. I paid for it myself. I called James Blake, who's the tournament director. I have nothing to do there as far as work-related. But me and my five best tennis buddies that I grew up playing junior tennis with,
no,
we're all getting together.
No.
A couple of them live in Florida. I said, I'm getting a suite. We're doing a night. Bring your wives. Bring whatever kids. You know, most of their kids are grown up. I have three teenagers. And we're all doing a night at the Miami Open during the week, the second week of Miami. So that's, my girls are on spring break. So
you got to give me the seat number. Yeah. You got to give me the suite number for that. Patrick William McEnroe, huge thank you. As always, I've known you a long time. You are released.
Thank you, sir.
Huge thank you to Patrick McEnroe. And thank you to Diodora. Use my code APPROVED in all caps at HollabergSports.com for 15% off of all Diodora performance tennis shoes. ScopeSports.io is the official fan club platform of the podcast. See them at ScopeSports.io. ScopeSports.io. Megan Fernandez edited the show. Our music is by Brian Senti. We'll be back next time with more of the most interesting voices in the sport. Until then, I'm Craig Shapiro, and you are released.